episode 193 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Tara Marshall is a woman with autism who wrote a post on Facebook against what might be called neurodiversity and extremism, people who complain that everyone with autism just thinks differently and sometimes thinks better than so-called normal people. They object to people who try to cure or mitigate their symptoms, such as Tara, who uses diet and other techniques. Anybody who has seen a video of a severely autistic child knows that while autism may sometimes be a mere difference of thinking, perhaps a gift, for others it is severely disabling and at other times devastating. Tara is far enough into the spectrum to know that she doesn't want to be there. It was an interesting, thought-provoking piece, so I knew I had to talk to her. Welcome to the show, Tara. So we're going to talk today about your diagnosis of autism, what we might call neurodiversity extremists, and how you have dealt with your autism symptoms.
Oh, I was just going to say that neurodiversity, there seem to be two different views in neurodiversity. There's the exclusive view and the inclusive view. And the exclusivists, as I tend to view them, tend to be the autistic supremacy type. And I really don't know how else to describe them, because they seem to think that all autism is always just a gift, and anyone who thinks that any symptoms of their autism that they don't like aren't a gift, are defective in the way we think. And they tend to say things that, like, all autistics can learn how to communicate, which, quite frankly, at this point, the clinical evidence would say otherwise. And I've worked with a lot of different augmentative communication devices and sign language, trying to help children learn to communicate. But then there's the inclusive type. And I'm good with inclusive neurodiversity, which tends to not just focus on autism, but includes people with other diagnoses, including epilepsy and Down syndrome, and says that there should be a value for a lot of different types of brains and their gifts, but that you need to accept that these gifts sometimes come with challenges, and that everyone deserves an education and therapy and other things that will allow them to address their challenges and use their abilities as best they can.
Right. I mean, I've seen a fair number of YouTube videos of what I might call extreme examples of autism, and I've seen children who are in their teens or in their 20s who are in diapers, who are nonverbal. And these appear to be extreme examples of autism, and often the parents say that this occurred after a series of vaccines or some other medical intervention. And I understand that not every case of what's called autism is the same, but I think most parents in this situation would say, you know, I love my son, usually a son, but sometimes a daughter. I love them very much.
My child's current existence is not a gift. It is a challenge.
Right. That if they could go back in time, they would change things.
Right. They would change. They would not get the vaccine. They would not give the Tylenol or whatever it was. I mentioned Tylenol because that's frequently given with vaccines. And if a person has an MTHFR gene mutation and can't get rid of heavy metals easily, then Tylenol can actually make that worse.
And Tylenol, of course, is given because vaccines often cause fever, which is a relatively minor symptom of vaccines, but Tylenol can be deadly in the wrong child.
Person, yes. I have a double MTHFR mutation and a COMT mutation myself. So
let's talk about your autism symptoms. And first of all, I'd like to say that I think that somebody who can talk about their own illness, if I can call it that, I don't know what's the right word for it, is quite brave, because you know, it's like talking. I mean, I think it's just brave
It's
to talk about these things. So
personal,
it's
yes.
personal. It's very personal, and no matter what your personal issues are, you might even think they're good things, but it's still hard to talk about your personal.
Well, there are good things and bad things that come with it. I was delayed in speech, but I was an early reader. So I actually would communicate at home in letter blocks that my father made for me before I could speak effectively. I had a degree of apraxia of speech when I was a child.
What term did you use?
Apraxia, APRAXIA.
Can
It
you
is
define that? Because I don't know what it is.
right. Okay, apraxia is a technical term. I don't know if you're familiar at all with dyspraxia. Okay, praxis has to do with movement.
Okay.
Dyspraxia is usually used for problems with fine motor coordination, such as an inability to hold a pencil or grasp it effectively. It's used a lot in occupational therapy.
Okay.
Apraxia is what they call it when a person has a similar disability, but specifically affecting the ability to organize the articulators, which would be the pieces of the throat and the mouth that we use to make the organized sounds that we consider language,
Right.
or that we consider verbal language,
So,
anyway.
how does this materialize in practice?
Okay. Well, most people who have apraxia have inconsistent errors in articulation. So they go to say a word, and if, for example, they're trying to say cow, they might manage to come up with ow, or they
Right.
might manage to come up with ow. Or they might, there's going to be 20 different variations,
Okay.
and whatever what happens is going to depend on how effectively they are currently able to move their articulators.
Their articulators by the parts of
Their
their.
articulators would be the lips, the tongue, the small muscles in the vocal folds, what you would probably call the vocal cords,
Right. So when you
things like
were
that.
learning to speak, how did you differ than for maybe it's a horrible word to say a normal child, a child in the 50th percentile?
Well, a lot of well, I had difficulty trying to say the words, but I also had difficulty remembering the words. I could remember them visually before I could remember before I could associate the sounds that the words actually made. So, for example, I could spell out the word milk quite fine.
Right.
I could have probably pointed to a picture of it just fine. I certainly could point to it in the refrigerator, but I could not remember the word to save my life.
And isn't it
So,
normal that verbal speech comes first? Because written.
usually verbal speech comes first,
Right.
right?
So, I mean, that's the most instinctive
Well, it's the
talent.
oldest form of communication,
Right.
but they have actually found, well, possibly the oldest. They have actually found that children can learn simple sign language before they can actually properly move their articulators to form verbal speech, which is why a lot of speech therapists will start with sign language, which I actually completely agree with.
Okay. But on the other hand, written language, whether you're writing or reading, is generally something that
Right.
comes much later.
That's usually, it's considered to be the newest form of language, and usually it comes much later in development. But I find in autism that sometimes is reversed. I've got a few kids that I work with who are pretty close to pre-verbal, who are learning how to spell and learning how to spell their favorite words,
Right.
to request things. And I've done this with 4 and 5 year olds
And so
who are pre-verbal.
you're working with children with some of the same challenges that you had when you were younger?
Yes, some of them have the same challenges. Some of them have completely different diagnoses.
So how old were you when your path diverged from this, quote, average child, or were you always different in your...
I was always different, but how much of that is related to other problems and how much is not is debatable. I was... Okay, my mother got a flu shot while she was pregnant with me. And she developed Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Guillain-Barré is a paralysis.
Right. It's a progressive paralysis autoimmune disorder. And she was in the hospital for a couple of months with that. You know, it's one of those things where fortunately she had recovered enough by the time I was born that she was able to go through a natural birth.
Right.
I guess that's a good thing. One of the interesting findings of my MRI is that I am missing the front half of my corpus callosum, which is the white matter of the brain that connects the two halves of the brain together, basically, which is part of why I have really horrible dyspraxia and I'll never be a good dancer.
I'm not a good dancer either, if it makes you feel any better, and
yes,
I don't have an excuse for it.
I have a valid neurological excuse.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's better than me.
But the thing is that they can't find anything in my genetics that would seem to indicate that that I should be missing the half my corpus callosum. It's called, the technical term would be partial agenesis of the corpus callosum, if anyone cares. But the interesting thing, though, is that they posit that the immune activation of my mother's immune system could have affected my fetal neurological development. So when you look at it from that perspective, there's the possibility I was born vaccine injured.
Right. I understand that. I mean, in the 1970s, there was the swine flu.
That was 74.
Right.
That was 76.
Right. There was a swine flu, prediction of a swine flu epidemic, and the government ordered this massive vaccination program, the American government. And it caused a massive epidemic of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is
right.
Essentially a kind of polio, which luckily for some people isn't permanent. But it's pretty clear it's a vaccine side effect.
There are a lot of immunological issues on my mother's side of the family, and I don't want to get into a lot of detail because it involves the lives of my aunts, and I don't have their permission to discuss
it. Sure.
I have two primary immunodeficiency disorders. Which most people have never heard of. But the IDF, the Immune Deficiency Foundation, estimates that 1 in 600 people overall have a primary immunodeficiency disorder. Only about half of those are diagnosed, so about 1 in 1,200 are diagnosed. But the interesting thing is that I was at an autism conference a couple of years ago, and Dr. Jim Adams here in Phoenix was saying that 1 in 4 autistic people have a primary immunodeficiency disorder in a study that he had been reading.
Well, Dr. Wakefield, who I'm sure you've heard of, got into a lot of trouble because he connected autism with gut abnormalities.
Right.
And that seems to be reported quite commonly in people with autism.
Well, the gut abnormalities thing is reported very commonly in autism. In fact, different gut disorders have been confirmed to have a higher association with autism several times. What got him in trouble was using the words measles vaccine, because that's what the parents said was when their children's problems had seemed to appear mostly.
Right, or specifically, I think the MMR vaccine, which is the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Mm-hmm. Although he never said...
he never said it was a causative factor. Right. I've read the original paper. He just said that the parents associated the onset of symptoms with the MMR vaccine and then reported on finding the measles virus in the small intestines of autistic children in his study, but not neurotypical children, which is certainly an odd thing. And there have been a couple of studies since, including one in Texas that I know of that confirmed the same thing. But there seems to be very little interest in follow-up, because as soon as you say autism and vaccines in the same sentence, everybody shuts you down and starts screaming about public health and, you know.
Right. I find this kind of remarkable because, you know, back in, say, the 1930s or 40s, autism was essentially unknown. It was an extremely rare condition. And now they're talking in children that I think if you project things... Right. And if you project out another 20 years into the future, it'll be like one out of two boys and, you know, a fairly high percentage of girls.
Right.
How can this be anything other than an environmental condition? And if it's not vaccines, then somebody better come up with some other cause.
There are several schools of thought, and there are some studies that seem to show that people who live in areas with coal-fired power plants are more likely to have an autistic child. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that's related to mercury poisoning or one of the other things that they talk about is still debatable.
That's part of the problem. A coal-fired power plant produces not just high levels of mercury, but a number of other toxic compounds, and maybe...
Chemicals.
Maybe that's just a surrogate for living in a more industrial area, and it's actually something completely different. Who knows?
Right. But the other thing, though, is that we're also talking about a disorder that is diagnosed entirely based upon symptomology, or disorder or difference, depending upon how much of it you have and how you want to speak about it. But the thing is that it's based entirely off of behavior at this point. You're looking just at the outside of the box, as it were.
Well,
you're not looking at what is the causative factor, because we don't have those yet.
Well, and there are certain things, as you pointed out, vaccines that we're not allowed to talk about. So if we could say that, for example, it was mercury, aluminum, or something completely different, then we could say, okay, it's the the mercury poisoning syndrome, and we could identify children, and maybe there's two or three different syndromes caused by different things.
Right,
but
and it fully depends on what you're looking at. I mean, they now have cerebral folate deficiency, which they just first discovered in, what was it, 2003, 2005, something like that, and it took 10 years to get accepted and for people to start writing more research about it, really. And now you've got children who are basically getting treated for cerebral folate deficiency, who they thought had really severe autism or really severe epilepsy. And these children, after treatment, are going on to be virtually typical in all their academic and social skills.
Right. So through B vitamin or folate, supplementation.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's usually folate supplementation in a dairy-free diet, because unfortunately the protein in milk can interfere with the synthesis of folate in the body, is my
understanding. Right, but that still brings up the question of how did they become folate deficient? Did they Did they just end up with a diet that was deficient in folate, or did
They
they end up with a
have
body that...
actually discovered a couple of gene mutations that are related to cerebral folate deficiency. Now, excuse me. This also brings up the question of some of the extreme neurodiversity advocates, if you want to call them that, say that treatment is out of the question and that anything that makes a person less autistic is not acceptable. Well, that would seem to rule out treating a child for cerebral folate deficiency, but leaving a child in that sort of state where they can't communicate and where they can't, in many cases, go through even an hour without having a seizure is inhumane.
Right. Now, let's talk about the definition of autism, because this is something that I'm, you know, I see this huge spectrum from children who are kind of a bit antisocial through children who simply cannot function because they're nonverbal, because they're incontinent, because they're going to be treated as essentially big babies for the rest of their lives because they don't have the capacity. And that's a pretty broad spectrum. So what
and
do you think autism is?
That's why it's called a spectrum.
Right.
Well, I try to look at it from both a personal perspective and a professional perspective.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at symptoms, we would say that pretty much every person who's diagnosed with autism, whatever the level, has some abnormalities in communication. It can range from just having difficulties with reading facial expression and body language all the way to being completely pre-verbal sometimes for their entire lives.
Right.
If we're talking about the internal experience for autism, what I see that the professionals still largely aren't talking about except for occupational therapists is that almost all of us seem to have some degree of sensory processing disorder, which we experience the world as too loud or too bright or not bright enough or not loud enough. Or what I've seen in a couple of cases with kids who are quite severely affected is that I've seen delays in sensory processing. And I'm going to give you a specific example here. A teenage boy I used to work with in a classroom, he suddenly started waving his arms around his head and screaming about bees.
Right.
And I had absolutely no idea why.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I did a little sleuthing because I get curious about why anything like that happens. And it turns out that half an hour earlier, another one of the aides in that classroom had brought that child down to throw away the trash, and there were bees near the trash can.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is, half an hour later, and this child has finally realized that there were bees there.
All right.
How is a child who has, and I timed this child with a stopwatch a few times. This is before there were, cell phones and stuff widely available. He had a variable delay in sensory processing from between 30 seconds to the longest I ever timed was about 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
How is he supposed to ever developed a sense of cause and effect?
Right.
So I say that the more extreme forms of sensory processing disorder can mimic a cognitive disorder, at least in their effects, in your ability to perceive the world as other people do and to interact with it in the way that other people feel is appropriate for your age.
Right. I mean, normally if you're you're going to respond to something somebody says maybe in milliseconds or a few seconds. And if you sit there for a minute, then
that processing
people
time.
Are going to think that that's a bit weird. And if it's 30 minutes, then they're going to go, well, we can't deal with this person. I mean, how could you hold down a job or something? If somebody tells you something and sometimes you do it right away and sometimes 30 minutes later you get up and take out the garbage, or whatever simple thing it is that you were asked to do?
This was simply the bees. You know, I don't know that he would have ever developed the ability to have anything that would resemble an independent job skill, independent employment, right, that particular person, just because of the severity of his sensory processing disorder, really. And he was actually, that was a really severe classroom. He was actually one of the quote-unquote higher functioning kids in that classroom. I don't really like the use of functional labels. I prefer to say that somebody is severely affected because it seems to place less of a sense of blame upon the person.
Right. I mean, there are people who simply think differently and don't respond in the same way as normal people. And sometimes those people have difficulty because they just don't really fit in. And it seems like the extreme neurodiversity people are saying, you know, just because you think different doesn't make you a lesser person. And that's certainly true.
Right.
But, and that applies, I think, to not just to autism, but to people who are, say, far more artistic or very different in other ways than the average person. But again, I go back to these children who are incapable of performing the most basic functions, such as being able to control their bowels or being able to speak.
Right, and that could be related to the sensory processing disorder, and it could be related to the third thing I haven't gotten to yet, which is that most autistic people seem to have some form of movement disorder.
Mm-hmm.
How extreme it is really seems to vary. There are some kids I've worked with, and I'm sure you've seen cases, who have almost no volitional movement, where they have little control over what's going on with their bodies.
Right.
And then there's people who just have some problems with apraxia occasionally, or people who just have some problems with basically being clumsy, which is the non-technical word for dyspraxia, dyspraxia anyway. So it's another thing that there's a variation upon. And obviously, the more control you have over what your body is doing, then the higher functioning you will appear.
Right.
You know,
but,
some
but,
people, yeah.
But to say, you know, to be tolerant of people's diversity is one thing, but to say that people who clearly cannot function in a normal way with very basic parts of life, to say that they shouldn't be touched, they shouldn't be changed. I mean, maybe
and
we can...
The problem is that until we have more medical diagnoses for subtypes of autism and treatments, like we do now for cerebral folate deficiency, then there's not going to be a change in all of that, because quite frankly, we are still looking at autism from a closed box perspective of a bunch of symptoms.
Right. So maybe now is a good time to talk about how you've dealt with your symptoms and how you've tried to ameliorate your symptoms.
Well, the very first thing I started with was I removed artificial ingredients from my diet. And I'm the kind of person where I delve into a subject and I started reading biochemistry and I started looking at how a lot of the artificial ingredients are vitamin B6 antagonists. And when you look at epilepsy, there is actually a link between B6 and seizures. There is a B6 deficient dependent seizure disorder, which is usually diagnosed in infants who are very severe. And I wondered if maybe I had a mild form of that. Yes.
I just said, I basically just saying, keep going.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misinterpreted you.
Yeah, no problem.
Which is fairly common in me. In any case, so I wondered if maybe I had that going on, and I was really tired of taking my Valproate every day because I was having breakthrough seizures anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I did is I removed the artificial ingredients from my diet. And, you know, after I had done that, 3 months later, I was pretty much seizure-free.
Okay, and so...
For the first time in my life that I know of.
Right, so eating organic, non-processed, I mean, what strategy?
Non-processed. I wasn't even organic at that point. Mm-hmm. I was just excluding artificial ingredients, artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives.
Right, so going to more basic ingredients as opposed to buying packaged foods that, I mean, if you buy Kraft Dinner... The list of ingredients is awfully long, and a lot of them are things that you have no clue what they are.
Right, and at that point, I basically just switched to mac and cheese that didn't have the yellow number 5 and 6 in it.
Right.
That the brand names usually had, mm-hmm. or the more common brand names usually had. So, and then after I did that, I started wondering, well, what about these other things that they say can help with autism? So the very first thing I did was I removed casein. Well, after that, the next thing I tried was removing casein. And, you know, 6 months later, it was kind of like a fog had been lifted a bit. But I wouldn't say it was terribly dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was one of those things where I seemed to be processing things faster, but I wasn't necessarily, it was like instead of being in a heavy fog, things were in a light fog.
So what is casein and where do you find it? Like where is it in food?
Casein is a milk protein.
Mm-hmm.
The form that most people seem to react to seems to be the cow milk protein form mm-hmm. of casein. I react very severely to goat and sheep milk. These years, at least, I don't react as badly to cow milk. So mm-hmm. I have added that back to my diet as long as it's lactose free. Yeah, it gets long and complicated.
Right.
So, after I did that, I'm like, there is actually a family history of celiac disease, although back in the 20s and 30s, they called it banana babies. But my grandmother was a banana baby. My mom was a banana baby. And then for a while when I was a kid, I was a banana baby too, because at the time they thought that a diet of only bananas or primarily bananas was the way to treat it.
Uh-huh.
Well, it is a gluten-free diet, which does treat celiac disease.
Right.
Right. So the first thing I did was, of course, because I do like to see medical confirmation, I ordered the test for celiac disease from my physician, who was like, well, what? Why do you think you have that? And it came back negative, which really surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the, so I'm like, well, is there anything that can cause it to be negative, a false negative? And she's like, yeah, but that's really rare. So I don't even see the point. But I got the, scope anyway. And lo and behold, I had celiac disease.
Okay.
So I was a false negative, but it still took me another 7 years to find out why.
Okay. And why was that?
That would be because I have total or absolute IgA deficiency. Okay. Ig is short for immunoglobulin. A is one of the 5 subtypes.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that's one of my primary immunodeficiency disorders. And in my case, I don't have any of the immunoglobulin that is supposed to protect your mucous membranes primarily. And I first got led to finding out that I had that in an autism study in which I had the unusual result of, in a stool sample, not having any secretory IgA, which is what they call the remains of IgA in your stool, and the form of it that should be used in your intestines to help protect them from infection. Well, I didn't have any, which, you know, the researcher from that study called me up and said, that's really weird, and you're the only person I've seen who's not severe who has this result. The other people who don't have any secretory IgA are all young children, and they're all very severely affected. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, that's weird. So then I started reading up on IgA, and I got it tested specifically. Now, what they're looking for in a celiac test is they're looking for levels of high IgA. If you have an IgA deficiency of any type, then you're never going to have high IgA, whether or not you have celiac disease.
Right.
And since I have no IgA in my system at all that they can find in my blood sample, then that actually is something very interesting. And it's actually the very first thing I have on my medical bracelet, because if they were to give me any blood products that contained IgA at the hospital, then I could very easily go into rejection reaction and die.
So.
And I made it to 35 without knowing I had it, mind you.
Okay, so I'm trying to get my head around this. So everybody has IgA except a few.
Almost. Mm-hmm.
And yet you are somehow super sensitive to it, because you're implying that if you were exposed to it, it would be a big problem.
Well, I don't have any in my body, okay? You can think of it as being kind of like a blood type. Mm-hmm. If you were blood type O and somebody gives you blood type, O is the universal acceptor. Okay. No. O is the universal donor. Okay. So if you're O and somebody gives you a blood, then you're going to go into rejection reaction because it's the wrong blood type. Well, this is just different. It's a blood product. IgA is a blood product. It's also part of your immune system. You can have deficiencies in any of your immunoglobulins.
Okay. And this, think this is related to celiac gluten intolerance?
Well, it seems that people who have IgA deficiencies are more likely to have celiac disease, but also are more likely to come back as false negatives because we're low in IgA, which is why they should be sending full numbers back to the doctors and not just saying, oh, no, the IgA levels are fine because it's not high.
Right.
the body is... Well, the IgA levels are not fine because they're non-existent.
So what changes happened in you? I presume you've gone to a gluten-free diet. What changes did you see when you did that?
Well, when I first went gluten-free, I didn't really notice anything at all until I reintroduced it to my diet 6 months later to see what was going to happen. And what I found out was that I am very sensitive to gluten, let's just say that my reaction to gluten is very much like severe food poisoning for about 3 days.
So I guess what I'm gathering from this is that the improvements were kind of slow and steady.
The improvements were slow in coming, but I found out that once I had removed gluten from my body, then my body was just like, oh, heck no, I'm not taking that anymore.
Okay. You described it being quite unpleasant when you tried to introduce gluten again.
Right.
We don't need to go into those details unless you want to.
Well, I'm not kidding when I say like severe food poisoning for 3 days. Let's just say that any time that I've had any sort of infraction with gluten sense, I end up sitting on the toilet for 3 days with a bucket in front of me for when both ends explode at the same time.
Okay. I think we've...
And then I have to spend another couple of days trying to rehydrate.
Right. Which would be the logical consequence of that kind of thing. I guess we've all experienced that on a small scale because of food poisoning. It doesn't sound like a very fun thing to do. And it also doesn't sound like, you know, if somebody told you that, you know, this was neurodiversity and you didn't need to change your life in any way because you're just the way you are, you might say, I don't want to be.
And there are some neurodiversity advocates who have me entirely blocked because I'm gluten-free.
Right. Which is...
Right.
This whole thing is kind of bizarre. It's a kind of extremism.
I don't understand that either. And soy produces the same reaction in me, so I'm completely soy-free as well. But I noticed about a year and a half after I went gluten-free that I was just starting to be able to read a little bit of occasional body language in real time. I had a teenage at the time, autistic client of mine, who's reasonably high-functioning out at the pool, and I was I watched him swim between a mother and her child, and I started to snap at him, and then I realized, wait, I saw that bond between the mother and the child. I've never done that before.
Mm-hmm. And you were disturbed that your autistic client had sort of gone through the bond?
Yes, he swam between a small child who was probably about one, maybe-ish, swimming from the father to presumably the mother. And yeah, I presume it was the father. It might have been a family friend. I have absolutely no idea. All I could see was that this was the child's goal, was to get to mommy.
Right, and if you come between,
just learning how to swim,
the child might freak out at that point. Right.
Not only the child might freak out, but the mother might freak out, and the child could. If the child loses sight of mom, the child might end up going in a completely different direction.
Right.
So obviously I did not tell him off for that. I just tried to point out that he should watch for small children and try to stay away from their path of movement. And, you know, I did explain to him that that this is a child who's probably swimming towards the mother and that, you know, cutting between them could have negative consequences.
Mm-hmm. How much have you learned from your clients? I mean, working with people who have their own challenges, not the same as yours?
Well, you know, I've learned that some children are really affected by diet and some aren't, and that some of them there's temporary effects from diet and that sometimes it goes away or sometimes the problems seem to disappear and they don't need to be on the diet anymore, at least temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really child dependent. There is a boy I worked with from when he was 2 till he lost his diagnosis when he was 8. And between 2 and 7, we knew when there was dietary infringement.
Mm-hmm.
He was extremely sensitive. He would break out all over the place on his body if he had gluten.
In what spots or?
And he would lose his, he would break out in eczema, basically. Then he would usually stop using his words for a couple of days once he got to, when he was about 4 and a half and he started being verbal. He would stop talking for a couple of days after a gluten or casein infringement. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, somebody allowed him to get into the goldfish again.
Right,
is
right.
how he usually said it because he went to an autism-free school.
I mean, is it always gluten intolerance, or are there children who
No,
have other...
there seem to be kids who have other issues as well. I've seen some kids who are fine as soon as GMO corn is removed from their diet. That was only one particular case, and it seems odd to me that it would just be GMO corn, but that all I'm saying is that there was significant improvement once they removed GMO corn from his diet.
So you're seeing these children as individuals with individual problems. It seems
Right.
like the what I might call the neurodiversity extremists are saying we can put everybody in a box and treat them to some extent in the same way.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's like people who say that now that there's a test for Down syndrome, we should be aborting all kids with Down syndrome. Well, no, not necessarily. But at the same time, that comes in a spectrum of ability and disability as well. And I've seen some kids with Down syndrome who have really enjoyable, wonderful lives. And, you know, I do like the show Born This Way occasionally. It's probably the only reality TV show I can bear to watch. But that isn't all cases of Down syndrome. I also see some kids who are preverbal and probably will be for their entire lives who are not able to use pictures to communicate or signs or anything else, who are basically the walking infants.
And also, I think the parents.
It really depends. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what causes one versus the other with autism or Down syndrome or anything else. And quite frankly, at this point, nobody seems to know what's going to make that sort of difference in most cases.
As somebody who's been blessed with three children who have no significant health problems of any kind, I cannot say that if one of my children had, say, autism or Down syndrome, that I would have been okay with that. I don't know how I would have dealt with it. It's very easy for me to be judgmental about parents who have children with challenges and say they should just, you know, love their child anyway. But I think that's pretty selfish on my part because I've never actually been there. Just like I've never been autistic. I've never been Down syndrome. So how do I really know what it's like? I've never been gluten intolerant.
There are people who say that I shouldn't say anything about children because I can't have children. Well, I've never been medically healthy enough to have children. And part of that's probably related to my different genetic mutations. And part of that's probably related to the celiac disease. And part of it's probably related to God knows what else. But I've had three miscarriages. And I got to the point after the third one where I was just like, okay, this is a message from the universe saying that I should not try to have children.
Yes. And, you know, we all have challenges, but that's a pretty big one. I mean, to a lot of couples, not being able to have a child is the time where they start to go into serious, you know, fertility treatments or adoption or something like that, right? Because it's so important. Okay. But
that is now my ex-husband.
Right. But I guess I'm saying that to a lot of people, fertility is a huge deal, right? And to say, okay, you can't have a child, but you still have a full life, that's really nice. But
well,
you might not
the
think.
The other thing that I've noticed is that I've noticed that a lot of children with special needs have been born from fertility treatments.
Which
so
is...
I tend to view significant repeated miscarriage events as the universe's way of saying, well, maybe you shouldn't have children, at least not with this person.
Yes, I mean...
It seems to be something in the genetics or something in something else isn't working.
Yes, and I've been kind of suspicious of fertility treatments because they clearly I mean, they're not natural pregnancies when the risk of, or when the chances of, a multiple pregnancy are that much higher than normal. It's clearly not normal, and
well,
so it doesn't surprise me.
In multiple pregnancies, there's going to be a higher risk of a few things to begin with anyways. That's just cerebral palsy.
Right.
Because of the lower birth weight of the fetus, there's a higher risk of cerebral palsy. And, of course, also of some other things that come with essentially being premature.
Right. I mean, there's probably quite a few women and quite a few couples who have no interest in having children, and that's
right.
Their choice. But in people who are infertile, either because they just can't get pregnant or because the pregnancy
right.
is keeping aborting, they probably want to have a child, and it's not a gift that they can't, in your case.
Well, I got to a point where once I got some of my genetic results back, that I was very grateful that I had not had children, that I had had miscarriages instead of having children, because after I got my genetic results back, I realized that I was likely to have been the mom who was at home miserable with a child with either severe special needs or a child who was dying.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a pretty hard thing to deal
and
with.
And either of those is, I don't think I would be the mom who's on YouTube talking about how awesome her child with infantile Tay-Sachs is, because if you know anything about that disorder, it's pretty gruesome, because there's nothing awesome about that at all.
Right. And I mean, I would hope that if I had had a child with a disability, I would have loved that child the same as my other children. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that I would have been happy to receive.
I'm not questioning that you should love the child. I'm just saying that when it comes to a disorder as severe as infantile Tay-Sachs, that this is one of the cases where abortion definitely is pretty much the only mercy that you can offer.
Mm.
And that even people of extreme Jewish faith, which I'm not Jewish or Christian, quite frankly. Even Orthodox Jews allow abortion in the case of infantile Tay-Sachs.
Yes.
They also encourage genetic screening so that they know both parents don't have it, and there's not as much of a worry of it.
Right, right. I mean, these are incredibly difficult circumstances. I had a discussion today about somebody who had quadruplets, and the doctors were saying you should abort two of them to give the other two a chance, but they had all four and they were fine. But what if they'd had all four and two of them were severe special needs? You know, then they would have said, I should have listened to the doctor. Like, these are not easy things for parents. And
you have to look at things and make your own decisions, but the reason I listed infantile Tay-Sachs as my particular no-go is because the child is born looking typical, and then they start to regress and lose skills in every area between about the ages of 1 and 2. And by the time they die, which used to be between the ages of 3 and 4 of because they couldn't swallow anymore, now you're kind of forced to insert a feeding tube, so now they usually die later of pneumonia. Because by that time, they are completely paralyzed, they're deaf, there is no measurable receptive or expressive language, there's no measurable level of ability to really interact with the world.
Right.
And frequently, by the time they're about 3 or 4, when they're awake, they're screaming in pain because, quite frankly, everything that's going wrong with their metabolism hurts. It's one of those cases that's the hard case where you can say that, yes, abortion is probably really the only mercy we can offer.
We're running out of time, and I don't
Oh,
want
I
to.
apologize.
It's okay. It's not your fault. I don't want to end on
A
a
sad note
negative,
or a horrible
a sad
right.
negative note. I don't want to make the world a wonderful place when it's not always a wonderful place. But
Right.
perhaps we can finish by you talking about some of the positive things you've learned from the challenges that
Well,
you've had in your life that other people don't.
it's interesting. And one of the things that I posit is that early disability can actually be a sign of later ability. For whatever reason, I'm really good at learning languages. I wasn't when I was a child. I had a darn difficult time learning language as a child. But then when I got older, my ex-husband's family spoke another language, and I picked it up pretty easily, and I took a few semesters, and after a little while, people started thinking I was his sister on the phone, because nobody who is American can speak Arabic fluently, quite frankly, unless they're Arabic American or Arab American. Except for a very few people, and I'm apparently one of them. I just pick up languages if I'm around them. I'm currently learning Spanish. I'm getting pretty close to fluency at this point.
Muy bien.
I used to be bilingual with French because I grew up almost bilingual with French. I've got 2 semesters of sign language, and quite frankly, if the language is European, if I can get people to slow down enough when they're talking, I can usually at least pick out what they're talking about.
Okay. Well, those are positive things. I mean, I think you understand there is a real diversity from
Of
people,
talents and ability.
right? People who will never really function well at almost anything, versus people who just think a bit different and maybe in some ways are smarter than average, and it's a spectrum.
And if I'd known that I was gifted in languages when I was younger, then I probably would have gone to university and learned a whole bunch of high-need languages right then, but I didn't know. The problem with a lot of programs for children with special needs is that they're focused entirely upon the disability. My school was so focused on the fact that I couldn't do math to save my life that they completely ignored what I was good at. And I didn't even know what I was good at.
Yes. Well, I think we could talk for a bit longer, but I
But
don't.
unfortunately, you have a show and you need to
Yes, I
finish
have
it.
only an hour to give this talk, and we've used up all of that time. So I would just like to thank you for I think what is difficult to share such personal information with the world, but I really appreciate it myself.
Yeah, well, I'm speaking mostly from a personal perspective. Obviously, I don't want to give medical advice to people. I certainly don't intend to. I'm not a medical doctor. Please seek testing if you suspect that there is anything medically wrong with your child, and then try to seek treatment from there.
Thank you for sharing, Tara. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, have a good night, David.
Thank you for listening to episode 193 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.